Moon and I have been riding for a long time. My stomach feels hollowed out, and I'm lightheaded as I bounce lightly up and down in the saddle. A strange, exhausted urge to laugh bubbles through me, until I realize that Prudence is probably waiting for me at home with dinner. Then I remember what time it is and come to the conclusion that she's probably called it a night and gone to bed by now. I'm fairly sure we are still headed in the direction of the burning bird's trajectory, towards the bright star in the west, if I remember correctly. I lean forward and let my chest rest against Moon's long neck, try to close my eyes. But I'm too anxious to rest. My body is being forced to run on nothing but daring and fumes, and I'm jittery with it. We pass by a giant boulder that lets me know that I'm entering into the forbidden zone. The forest is denser here. Protect it from us people. The calls of beasts I don't recognize echo beneath the dense canopy of trees. I keep going, Moon's careful step slowing as we are swallowed into the dense, close-standing trees and wild brush. Leaves cover everything like a never-ending red and yellow blanket. As far as I can tell, no one else had the bright idea of taking off after the flying fireball, or bird, or whatever it is. People were screaming on the beach and running away. As tired as I am, I'm wondering if maybe that would have been the smarter response. I'm about to give up, to turn around and go home and hope Prudence has left me some cold stew. But then I see it. It's no longer completely engulfed in flames. The dense, wet leaves and soggy forest floor have dampened the fires. The flying object is far larger than I thought. Far larger than Moon, if I go by its wingspan. I dismount and slowly creep towards it. Moon stays back, not wanting to go near the small fires that still crackle angrily, trying to stay alive in the moist forest. On top of the flying object's middle, a small flame still burns brightly. When I get closer, I see that it's not a bird at all. It's made of material, but not of bones or feathers. It's made up of stone or some sort of metal. Where the moon shines through the trees, the flying object glints, shiny with its reflection. A scream, not of a beast, but of a human. My heart pounds in my chest, yet somehow my feet keep moving, then I'm sprinting towards it. There's someone inside. Someone has been eaten by the thing and is trapped within. I have to get them out. The middle is built like a little hut, almost. It's a room of sorts. It has a door that I can see as I get closer and a long window facing me. The window has been shattered. Jagged shards are exposed like fangs. As I get closer, I can see a body. It's crumpled up, its head thrown back like the person inside is trying to take a nap. There's a hat on the head that encases the entire head. The hat also has a window. It's open, and the person's eyes are exposed. I crouch down and peer into the broken window and ask as gently as I can, "Are you okay?" The eyes move to look at me, and then there is another scream. I don't want to, but I take a step back. It feels like a betrayal. Someone in so much pain, you shouldn't be allowed to take a step back. So I go to the side of the strange flying object and pull on the door handle, but nothing happens. Then I can hear the person inside moving around, and the door makes a clicking sound, and I am able to open it. It creaks loudly, and I turn around to make sure nothing in the woods has heard us, has marked us for death, before I quickly pull it open all the way. The figure is sitting in a chair that holds it in by a strap, and I cut the strap away and try to pull them out. A strange sound comes from somewhere inside the flying object, a high-pitched whistling and crackling. Lights glow and blink on the wall in front of the chair, just beneath the broken, cracked window. The body is limp, and another scream escapes and echoes in the small chamber. Then no more screaming, just mumbling that I can't make out. I pull the limp body outside and lay it down onto the wet leaves next to one of the small fires. The branches above us have been cut away by the flying object on its way down, and the moon and the fire allow me to see the screaming man, for he is a man. I pull off the giant hat, and beneath it there is a tussle of jet-black hair and a burned forehead, and when I look at the rest of his body, I see that most of it has been burnt as well. It smells like poacher stew. Where the skin is exposed, it's bubbling and mixing with the cloth he's wearing, and when I touch the strange garment that covers the man from his ankles to his wrist and neck, I find that it's smoother than anything I've ever touched before. The fabric covering his shoulders has strange ridges, and his chest has a long line of metal down the front that has melted into the skin below. When I try to pull it off, the man yelps a little, and I stop, because I don't want to hurt him more than he already is. His hands are almost like mine, but his palm shines silver like stone, and so do his fingertips. Something else is mixed into him, something more like the machine that he was riding through the sky than what makes him fully animal like me. I ask him again if he is okay, and this time he answers me. His eyes are filled with fear, but they are different than mine. His tongue is different too, and when he speaks, I can tell that he's saying words because he pauses in between them, but they are not words I have ever heard before. I run back to the broken birdhouse to see if there is water or anything else I can use, but I can't figure out how to open anything along the wall still blinking wildly with lights. So I run back to Moon and get some from my saddle and bring it to the man, who drinks hungrily and smiles, but then stops breathing. For a second, I wonder if it was the water I gave him that killed him, but then realize it probably wouldn't have mattered what I did, that time was slipping for the man no matter what, as burnt as he is. I am too tired to get back on my horse right away, and so I sit with the man's body until the little fires all go out and release themselves into puffs of smoke, and I listen for wild animals, but I hear none, and I thank Gara for that. When I have gathered enough strength, I drag the man's body over to Moon, and it takes a long time, but I can't leave him here to be eaten by the beasts of the Forbidden Zone. This feels like it would make crossing over even more of a sin, though I can't explain why. With the last of my strength, I hoist the man over my saddle, like I did Sid the night before. But without Colin's help, it is far harder, and it takes several tries. The man still feels warm, and for a second I think he's still alive. But then I realize it's the burns that cover his body, and I have to stop for a moment and be still. On my third try, I finally get him over the saddle and tie him down. When I ride back, I am the coldest I have ever been in my life. Too cold to care, to think too much about what I'm doing. I ride through the empty streets of the outpost back to the law office and drag the body inside. Numb as numb can be, I drag the body down the stairs into the basement beneath my office. Alone, with no one to hold the bulb and turn the lec box, I do this in the dark. And in the dark, I pull Sid, lying dead on his plank, back up the hole, and haul the burnt man's body on top of Sid's. I am too tired to cover the man in cloth properly, and so I lay only a single sheet across them both before lowering them back down into the well that has no water. I stagger back upstairs, barely aware of opening and closing doors on my way out, of mounting Moon, of making it home to my own hut. My boots don't leave my feet. My dirty clothes don't leave my body, and I sink into my bed without checking the kitchen for cold soup. Bone tired meets dead tired, and I drift down a dark pit of sleep, as black and silent as the one Sid now shares with the burnt man. When I finally wake the next morning, my stomach is an empty furnace and the sun is starting to creep through my window. I shield my eyes and curse at everything, but especially at myself for oversleeping. I roll off the bed and start frantically looking for my lec box and attach it to my wave box and begin to churn. The last of the morning gospel pours out of the wave box speaker before it ends and the box is quiet again, with the occasional humming or squeaking sound, though I don't know what those are. I stop churning the lec box and fight the urge to crawl back into bed. I rub pine from a jar against my neck and palms and inhale the musk it releases. The only good thing about this morning is that I don't have to get dressed. My mud cake boots have soiled the blankets on my bed, but I am too tired to care. My face feels like it's hanging from my skull, and I rub my burning eyes. Maybe I can sneak a nap in my office later. Before I leave for the diner, I should make sure Prudence isn't worried about me, and I leave my hut and cover the short distance to hers next door. But when I knock, no one answers. Finally, I push the door open and make my way down the short hallway to her bedroom. The bed is made, neat as ever. The hut is terribly quiet. For a moment, I wonder if Prudence went looking for me last night. But then I remember that she's probably in no condition to ride around the forest. Fear pushes onto my chest. I run into her kitchen, but it's empty as well, and so is the backyard that we share. I even check the outhouse before it dawns on me. I sprint towards my own hut and tear the door open. I run through the door and into my kitchen, and there is Prudence. I can't tell if she meant to fall asleep or if she fell, but she's curled up on the kitchen floor and there is some blood. Not small dots like before, but small splatters that cover her sleeves, and when I bend down to pull her up by the shoulder, Prudence barely opens her eyes. I slide my arms under her shoulders and her knees and lift her up. She's gotten so thin, it's like carrying a child. I carry her back over to her hut and to her bed. Then I slip the bloody shirt from her and put on a clean one. Splatters along the sleeves, across her chest. I prop Prudence up in bed and run to the fire pit to boil water. Then I run back into the bedroom to watch Prudence's chest lift and sink while the water boils. She's alive. I push my head against her chest, and her heart is present, beating steadily, at least as far as I can tell. But I'm no healer, nor am I a tender. I know nothing about what a healthy heart should sound like. I try to get Prudence to wake, and finally she does, groggily looking at me through heavy lids.
"I'm sorry I didn't find you sooner."
My voice is a squeak. Prudence smiles weakly and mumbles something I can't make out. Making sure she's comfortable, I run back out to get the hot water and boil herbs that are supposed to give you wakefulness. Prudence manages to sip down half before a coughing fit shakes her so mightily the mattress of her bed shakes in its frame. I stroke her forehead as she slowly starts to come around.
"I don't remember coming to bed."
Her voice cracks, but she doesn't cough again. I will the coughing away with my mind like I can control it, and hand her a cloth to cough in for the blood.
"I brought you to bed,"
I say and look down at my lap. Then I take her hand and pull it close to me. If we're connected, she can't be taken.
"Prue, how sick are you?"
For a moment, I think she's going to feign drifting into unconsciousness. But then she clears her throat and says,
"Mr. Pelion says I have some time left."
Mr. Pelion is the healer in town, and I did not know that Prudence had been to see him.
"When?"
I ask.
"I went about 6 months ago, when it started to get worse.
The hacking from her hut that lasts all night."
"Probably not much longer now,"
Prudence adds. She doesn't sound angry. She doesn't sound like she's going to fight it. But no one can fight the red cough. It comes and takes anyone who has it, and Prudence is getting old. She was older than my mother when she took me in, though I never thought to ask her how old she is. To me, she has always been so solid. Solid as this hut, as the oak tree growing out front. Like she couldn't go anywhere, even if she wanted to.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
There is anger in me, somewhere, but I can't figure out how to find it. Like grasping at air, it escapes my grasp and I don't try to catch it.
"You have your life,"
she says.
"I just wanted to make sure you didn't worry for longer than you had to."
"But now it's too late." I'm crying, wet little girl tears.
It was too late 6 months ago, just the same as it is now. She strokes the back of my hand with her thumb. My hand is clammy and hers dry and wrinkled like paper. You're going to be fine, Harper. You were always going to be fine, no matter what I told you.
I'm going to get Mr. Pelion. I let go of her hand and stand and startle when there is a knock at the door. Not this door. Mine. Sheriff!
Colin's voice sounds panicked. Go see what he wants.
Prudence says, her voice still weak, but I do as she says. Colin is pacing about outside, and I come up behind him just as he is trying to catch a glimpse through my bedroom window.
Do you always creep around people's houses when you're trying to find them?
He yelps, not having heard me, behind him. He grabs his chest.
Do you always scare the living daylight out of people when they're just trying to alert you of a crime?
Crime?
Yes, crime.
Jacob appears from the other side of my hut. What is going on? I don't like Jacob being near my home or near Prudence. Protective instincts raise my hackles. Men do things when they feel like their fathers have scorned them. Things I don't want to imagine.
Well, I came to the diner to try to find you two, because I know y'all get quite cozy for breakfast.
I want to roll my eyes, but mostly, I just want to get back to Prudence, and maybe my impatience shines through because Jacob stops.
Everything all right?
No.
Don't cry. Not in front of Jacob. Hold it together, Harper. I rub my eyes.
Prudence.
I wave at her hut.
She's really sick. Oh, I think she has the red cough. No, I know she has the red cough. She's not okay. I found her on the floor this morning.
Oh, no.
Colin looks at me.
Does she need help?
I shake my head.
It's too late for that. We should get Mr. Pelion or a tender, but I don't really know of any in the outpost that are free right now.
A tender is someone who doesn't try to heal, but as the name implies, simply tends to those waiting to cross over. As I say this, I realize that Prudence is going to die, that she is little use for Mr. Pelion at this point, that I am going to lose her, that she isn't the oak tree growing up front.
Scully's mother is a tender,
Jacob says out of nowhere. I look up at him.
She is?
How do you know that? I want to ask, but then realize they've been spending a lot of time together trying to track down the thief who stole old Rainier's cooking pot.
Scully's at Sid packing up all the things he left behind, but I could ride over to her mother's and see if she can take care of Prudence.
That would be amazing.
I'm not sure if Jacob has been replaced by a non-evil doppelganger, but right now I just need help, and I'm willing to take it from anyone.
Wait, why are you here?
Jacob has already mounted his horse and taken off halfway down the drive, so I turn to Colin.
Someone shot Abe.
Wait, what? Okay, let me make sure Prudence is all right, and then we'll deal with this.
I lead Colin back into the hut and into Prudence's bedroom. She smiles at him, as the old Sheriff Wilson and her knew each other growing up, and she's known Colin since he was a baby.
Hey there, Colin.
Her voice is a whisper. Colin grins at her like everything is normal.
Hey, Prudence. I hope you don't mind. Jacob's gone to fetch someone to give you a hand around here for a bit.
Oh, I don't mind at all.
She looks at me, and a small smile plays across her face.
This one might actually have to cook for herself for once, so please make sure she doesn't starve.
I ignore her words and stroke my hand over Prudence's forehead, hot, hot against my palm. Can't pretend that things are normal. I sigh and put my hands on my hips. Then I drag Colin out back to boil more water while we wait for Jacob to return.
Where did Abe get shot?
I watch the pot dangling over the mellow flame.
He was right outside his own hut, by the workstation. Della found him. She brought him inside.
Wait, he's still alive? Did he see the guy?
Yes, he's alive. No, he didn't see who it was. Apparently it was this morning and still dark. Della doesn't know what he was doing outside. She found him, and he was shot through the leg. Another bullet hit him in the shoulder. She only knows he was shot outside because there was a trail of blood.
Where did she find him?
Looks like he was able to run back into the workstation and get the door shut in time. It sounds like the guy was coming after him. Why else run?
Huh. I say, and stoke the fire. Where is Abe now?
He's at home. Della was able to patch him up, but he'd lost some blood by the time she found him. I think Mr. Pelion was on his way there when Jacob came to the diner to get us. But of course, I was there alone.
Sorry, it's just with prudence. Colin raises his hand.
No need to apologize, Sheriff. I know how much she means to you.
I mean, yeah, she's my mother. Colin looks like he's about to say something, but thinks better of it. When Jacob gets back with Scully's mother, we should go over to Abe and Della's. I decide out loud. Colin looks at me and furrows his brow.
You sure you want to leave Prudence?
That old bird isn't going anywhere. I try to sound tough, but really, part of me can't stand to be here. I can fake normalcy anywhere but in her bedroom, it appears.
Right, yes, you're right.
Colin agrees. So Abe didn't see the guy?
I'm not sure. Della ran over to old Rainier's and thank Gara Saley happened to be there. She wrote to Jacob, who
came to the diner to find us. I finish Colin's sentence.
What a mess, I add.
The water starts to boil and I take the pot off the hook to pour more brew for Prudence. When we enter back into her bedroom, a gentle snore is coming from her pillow. The blankets are piled high around her and she looks completely fine, except that maybe she is a little thinner than before, a little more wan. But in the dim room, she could just be sleeping in that day, nothing worse than that. We can hear the sound of two horses trotting up to the front of the hut, and Colin touches my shoulder gently. I stop staring at Prudence, and we let Jacob inside, as well as Scully's mother, a small, spunky woman named Rita, who seems ready to take over the house the second she steps foot over the threshold. I can see where Scully gets her enthusiasm.
Where is she?
Before I can say anything, Rita has already taken off towards the bedroom, a little satchel in hand.
She's great,
Jacob says, approvingly. I don't ask how he knows her this intimately. When I follow Rita into the bedroom, she's already sitting next to Prudence on the bed, lighting fire to herbs on a small tin plate. The smells are strange, but Prudence smiles when she sees me. Go, she says quietly. I'll see you when you get home from solving crime all day, Sheriff Rose. For once, I don't roll my eyes at her. We leave Prudence in Rita's care and get on our way to Abe and Della's. A cold wind whips around us, and I wish I had worn an extra layer. I let Jacob and Colin get ahead of me so that their bodies can shield me. From behind, they look almost identical. Two tall figures riding on horses, one black horse, one white. Tufts of dark hair twisting with the wind underneath their almost identical hats. Shoulders equally broad. If they switched horses, I wouldn't be able to tell them apart. Hey, Jacob? The words are lifted out of my mouth and are almost eaten up by a gust of wind that rips towards us from across the fields. But he hears me, and without turning around, replies,
Yes?
Thanks for getting Rita for Prudence. I wouldn't have known where to find a healer that quickly. For a moment, we ride on in silence before he answers me.
You're welcome.
It's possible he said something after that, but the wind picked it up and threw it in the opposite direction of my ears. We ride past the fields and the berry farms and finally make it out past old Rainier's and ride up to Abe and Della's hut and workstation. It's like the day is frozen in mid-morning. The sun remains hidden behind gray skies, and it feels like it hasn't truly risen, even though it's well past noon. Abe's voice echoes out the front windows, he's agitated as ever. And another voice, Della, is arguing with a third. I'm assuming it's with Mr. Pelion, the healer. What's going on here? All three of us, almost the entire law office, rush the front room, and I make a show of reaching for my gun to quiet them.
He wants to take the bullet out.
Abe looks pained. One of his pant legs is pulled up high, and his calf is wrapped in white cloth, which is weeping blood in a large circle.
You don't want him to take the bullet out?
It's not like I have any idea about this kind of thing. Personally, I'd want it removed, but Abe looks horrified by the idea.
No, it will heal easier if it just stays in.
Abe sounds adamant, but he also doesn't look like he totally has his wits about him.
Last year when my cousin accidentally shot himself, they took out the bullet. He died because it turned black after.
Della tries to explain Abe's logic.
Mr. Pelion, I think if Abe really wants to keep the bullet in, you should just help him clean the wound and dress it properly.
I look over at the man, who looks exasperated after dealing with Abe and Della.
Sure, if that's really what you want.
He turns to Abe, and there's coldness when he adds,
But if you lose the leg later on, don't come crying to me.
Then he pulls the white cloth from Abe's calf, dips clean cloth in brown liquid, and starts washing over the hole in Abe's leg that is leaking blood all over the floor in between the chair Abe is sitting in and where Mr. Pelion is crouched down before him on the ground.
Della, can I talk to you outside?
She doesn't look away from her father and Mr. Pelion, but replies,
Sure, just until after this is done.
I'm sure Mr. Pelion can finish just fine without you watching.
I walk out the door without waiting for her to reply, and she follows me out.
What?
She sounds pissed.
I turn to her.
Della, I know you're upset because your father was just shot, but I'd really like to find who did this so he doesn't try again.
Or so whoever did this doesn't try to shoot anyone else. Did he see anything?
Della wraps her arms around her chest. It's freezing out. The strange gray light of the sun blocked by the clouds makes everything look strange, dreamlike.
He says he didn't see anything.
She says and squeezes her arms more tightly around herself. He says he heard something out by the workstation, and that when he went in there, he heard a noise outside.
Colin appears in the doorway, and I rub my forehead with my left hand. Our signal for, interrogate the other witness, please. Usually, the so-called witnesses are the wife, husband, or lover involved in a bar fight over at Tarango's beer hall. But since people tend to remember things occurring very differently, even just about who hit whom first, we've had to come up with a system. Colin disappears back into the hut.
So he heard a noise outside.
I draw Adela's attention back towards me before she can look back at the hut.
Yes. He said he heard something out in the front path. And when he walked down, halfway,
Della points to where there's a few drops of blood next to us on the path.
Someone shot him. They just shot him.
There was more than one? For a moment, Della looks confused.
No, I mean, I don't know, maybe.
Okay, and then what?
Della shrugs. He ran back inside. They got his leg first. But he says he didn't even notice he was shot until he turned around and they shot him again.
She touches her own shoulder as if she were the one that was shot.
That, he says he felt, not the one in the leg, but the one in the shoulder. Burning, he said it felt like hot, like someone dumped hot water on his shoulder.
That's not even the one that stayed in, isn't that weird? But that's the one he felt. Tore off some of his skin, though. But otherwise, nothing.
Can you show me where he was standing when he was shot in the shoulder?
Now, Della looks confused, like she hadn't thought of this until now. She seems uneasy.
It must have been when he turned to close the door. It hit him in the front, clipped him, right here.
She touches her own shoulder again. Slowly, we walk to the entrance of their workshop, at the end of the drive, and just past the entry to their hut. We stop just before the entrance. It's a gate that pulls down from the ceiling, many short planks of wood held together by a thick rope. It slinks upward along the ceiling as Della tugs on the rope to open it, making a rattling sound as it goes. She tries to reenact what happened to her father and turns as if she is about to pull the gate back down, looks down at her shoulder and back towards inside the workshop. Before she can be the first to find the bullet,
I push past her as gently as I can. The trajectory would have caused the bullet to hit the wall immediately behind the door or the floor in front of it. I haven't seen Abe's shoulder, and now I'm kicking myself for not checking the wound first. I have no idea what the angle of the trajectory might be. The workshop contains things I don't recognize. There are round pieces of metal in every size imaginable. Some have square edges like teeth, some are smooth, some are jagged like they're meant to be weapons. Cables, buttons, and cranks to churn things are all stacked high on the shelves that line every wall. The floor is littered with Lekbox and Wavebox casings, hollow, their inside scooped out. I've never seen them like that before. To me, they have always been perfect boxes with one single function. Lekbox, churn to get electricity. Wavebox, turn on to listen to the gospel, turn off when the gospel ends. To think they have different parts inside of them makes me feel uneasy. Could anyone be hurt by touching the parts that make them work? The bullet is either somewhere in the mess on the floor or lodged into the wall with the shelf. I scour the ground and find nothing. The shelf at the back of the workshop that directly faces the door contains large metal boxes. In the back of the top shelf, on my tiptoes, I can see that a bullet has bored its way through one of them and is stuck in the wall. Della is behind me now that I have stopped pacing through their shop. You find anything? She sounds nervous. Yeah, bullet. I stick my hand through the empty box and try to pull it out of the wall, but it's wedged tight. You have anything I can use to pull this out? Della searches the shop for a minute and then hands me a long metal stick. I wedge it beneath the bullet and shimmy it loose. Finally, it falls out of the wall and clunks into the metal box on the shelf. When I pick it up, it looks like a 9mm, pushed flat, and strangely, I have the thought that it looks like a flower. We have to find the casings, I say, more to myself than to Della, and start walking back outside, dropping the bullet into a cloth pouch tied to my belt. Colin meets me outside, and we search through the bushes outside the house as we compare the stories of Della and Abe. They seem to match.
What I don't get is why anyone would want to shoot Abe in the first place.
Colin kicks aside some dirt that looks freshly turned.
Especially with what happened with Kalila last year.
I agree. Abe's wife died of the red cough, and I think of Prudence back in her hut.
Also, it's not like Abe has any enemies. We need Abe. Without him and Della, we'd have to go 4 outposts over just to find a decent Lekbox repair shop.
I don't disagree. Della and Abe are known to be the best in the area when it comes to repairing anything that needs to be churned to run.
Whoa.
Suddenly, Colin has wrapped his arms around my waist and is holding me still.
What in Gara's name are you doing?
I turn to look at Colin, his head pressed beneath my armpit.
Can you let me go, please? Have you lost your mind?
Look,
he says. I look to where he is pointing. Half a footprint, just ahead, behind the tree in front of us. Exactly where I was about to step.
Oh,
I say, and Colin releases his grip from around me. We both just look at it. It's barely visible. The lines were held in place by the early frost that covers the ground. I kneel down and take a closer look. Lines going left to right and lines going up and down. A perfect grid of squares. Beside it, shell casings.
It's the same one as in Rainier's fire pit.
Both of us turn at the same time, looking towards Rainier's hut that's just barely visible through the trees, whose branches still cling to a few dried leaves here and there. We wait for a moment, as if anticipating an obvious answer to float up from the shoe print, some obvious reason why stealing the pot from Rainier could somehow be linked to Abe being shot through the leg, but nothing comes to mind.
I think we should talk to Abe, see if he remembers anything else.
I start walking back towards the hut. When we get back inside, Abe is still arguing with the healer, and we ask him to leave. But Abe doesn't have anything else to add to the story, and soon he is worn out and has to go lie down.
This is so frustrating.
I complain to Colin and Jacob as we ride away from Abe and Della's hut. I get the distinct feeling that Della knows something but won't tell me, and we can't help them if they won't talk.
What do you think it is?
I shake my head. I have no idea. I don't think it's a coincidence that someone with those boots trampled through old Rainier's yard, and I'm starting to think they went to the wrong house.
You think Abe was the target all along?
Colin says. What do you think? I level at Jacob, who has been awfully quiet for once. He looks over the neck of Colin's horse Trapper and at me, almost startled.
I think they're connected, but I don't think Della will say anything until they are scared enough, so it's best to wait.
What do you mean, scared enough? You think he'll try again? But as I say it, I know that Jacob is right. The shooter missed. Abe is alive. One bullet, that could conceivably be an accident. Two bullets, that's just not. We are running out of law to do stakeouts.
Are we going after the berry thief tonight?
Colin sounds weary, and I shake my head. It's too late now. Let's just hope that they didn't strike again today, and we'll tell the farmers it was a strategic move. Tell them they were right that the thief would know we'd be waiting. Tomorrow we'll catch the guy. Considering where we found Sid, maybe all of this is connected.
You think the thief did the shooting?
Colin asks. I shrug. There's nothing linking Sid to Abe getting shot, or old Rainier getting his pot stolen. For now, I'm going to say no, but let's keep an open mind.
Speaking of Sid,
Jacob pipes up.
Scully might need our help getting all that stuff back to the office. I went over there this morning to take a look, and it's quite a lot.
Sure, why not? How bad can it be with four horses? We ride through the center of the outpost. It's empty of worshippers now that the sun has started to set. The worshippers are apparently all making their way down to the beach, despite last night's event. It's not like anyone got hurt, I think, other than the guy in the flying object. For a second, I almost say something to Colin and Jacob, but something holds me back. The strangeness about the burnt man, maybe. His hands that made him seem less human, or the way his clothes felt. I tell myself I'll tell them when the time is right, when we have less going on. Maybe tomorrow, or the day after. Maybe, after we catch the berry thief, and have apprehended the shooter as well as Sid's murderer, and have also located old Rainier's cooking pot. Maybe I'll tell them then. When we pull up to Sid's house, Scully is waiting inside. All three of us groan when we see the boxes stacked high in the living room.
What?
Scully looks insulted. You said to pack everything that wasn't nailed down.
But you took the paintings, which actually kind of were nailed into the wall.
Colin groans louder and then laughs in exasperation. I sigh. Let's just get started. This is going to take more than one trip. It's long dark by the time we have finished bringing all the boxes containing Sid's stuff inside the law office. Three runs, not one, even with all four horses. We start to unpack some of them, covering desks and file cabinets completely. When we are done, it looks like someone insane has moved in, and we stand there for a moment before we all start laughing.
We do not look like a respectable law office. We look like our Aunt Kathleen has moved in.
Colin says and wipes his forehead, wet from the effort.
Kathleen would feel right at home here.
Jacob agrees, and their eyes meet, and they smile.
You said anything not nailed down.
Scully raises her palms. I was just following orders. It's quiet for another moment, and I realize this is as good a time as any. I clear my throat and say, not so much to anyone in particular, but more just into the middle of the room, I have something I need to show you. Then I head into my office and down the stairs into the basement room.